The views expressed on the Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, Friends of Community Radio, or any of the affiliate radio stations airing the show. You're listening to WSFMLP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard in KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. Also, if you're interested in rebroadcasting any episode or segment, you're free to do so. Just send us an email so we know that you're out there. If you care to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806. The show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee, located at 610 Haywood Road. Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville, specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. You can find a sample of Firestorm's catalog of books and zines, plus a full calendar of events at their website, firestorm.coop. Some words from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain. What you say, what you say, what you say, what?
This is so outrageously crazy. I couldn't even make this up. In the context of police declaring open season on black people, and in a new era where we finally have black people targeting cops in retaliation, we can assume that the state's fascist enforcers in blue are doing everything they can to conduct themselves properly. You know they have to be on their best behavior. So check out what the police do when they're on their best behavior. They responded to a scenario where an autistic kid had walked away from a care facility. From what I could tell from the video, the kid looked to be non-white. So a therapist from the care facility, realizing the kid had walked away, went to collect him and return him. The therapist wasn't wearing fatigues and combat boots. He didn't have a flak jacket or a bazooka. But he was black. So you know that can't end well. If you haven't already seen the video, let me give you the scenario. When police arrived, the autistic kid sat down and began playing with a toy truck. The therapist, an unfortunate black man who clearly knows the score, laid down on his back with his hands up, clearly empty. As heard on the video, the therapist told police that he worked for the care center. In a calm voice, he identified himself and explained that the young man was autistic. He clearly articulated that the autistic kid was unarmed and was merely playing with a toy truck. So, once police determined they had two unarmed and perfectly cooperative people, they took the opportunity to shoot the black man in the leg. Really, I'm not making this up. Police took a situation of perfect peace and tranquility and interjected flying bullets as a solution, while on their best behavior. Apparently, in recognition of the proposition that black lives really do matter, cops are no longer killing black people, but are instead just shooting to maim. That's quite an advancement. But wait, it gets weirder. In the aftermath, police have released an official statement to explain themselves. They claim they didn't intend to shoot the compliant black man laying on his back with his hands up. Instead, they claim, their target was the mentally challenged unarmed kid. Somehow, police think the story is more acceptable, that they were trying to shoot an autistic kid playing with a toy truck, and that they accidentally shot the black man they were trying to save. I bet that sounded better in the police chief's head than it did when he actually said it out loud. There's just so much wrong with this. Cops are now shooting black people to save them. So whether the black person is a perceived aggressor or a perceived victim, the answer is to shoot the black guy, sometimes for his own good. After all, if cops had not shot that guy in the leg, an autistic kid may have bumped his foot with a toy truck. Now cops can shoot black people and say, "You're welcome." Wow. With this accidentally shooting black people for their own good defense, we've now heard just about everything. I'm now only waiting for an official police response that questions whether bullet manufacturers are secretly producing ammunition with black people magnets in them to explain why white cops always seem to shoot black people. You know, it's not me, it's these damned black people magnet bullets. I bet that therapist now wishes he had taken my advice and worn a gorilla suit to go out and pursue that walkaway kid. After the death of Harambe, cops would more likely think twice about taking down another gorilla and suffering the white backlash than shooting black people like they do all the time. This situation also reminds me of one that involved Jeffrey Dahmer, the cannibal serial killer. If you remember, on one occasion, a naked boy escaped from Dahmer's home, and when police encountered Dahmer and the child, they didn't shoot Dahmer in the leg. Instead, they gave the naked boy back to Dahmer, who went home and raped and then ate him. Apart from the difference that the boy Dahmer was pursuing was naked, and if the therapist could verify his credentials, what this comparison proves is that whatever the circumstances, if you're black and pursuing someone, cops will shoot you. In contrast, if you're white, the cops will facilitate your effort to rape and eat naked children. There's a subtle racial bias. The black pursuer walks with a limp for life, while the white cannibal rapist eats like a champ for a week or more thanks to police intervention. You know, to protect and to serve. Now, before I wrap this up, I'd like to share a concern that so far, as it's been reported, only black shooters are killing cops, which serves to increase the tension between cops and the black community. This has to end. We definitely need some white shooters, especially the way things are stacking up. Donald Trump promises to be the law and order candidate, doing everything possible to support the cops. That being the case, I think Trump isn't really building a wall to keep the Mexicans out. He's building a wall to keep the black people in. Us whites might have to take up arms to hold off the cops long enough for the black population to escape to a civilized country. Let's lock and load. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Warren Correctional in Lebanon, Ohio. If you're shooting back, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain, 243-205, Warren, C.I., P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. president in 2016, and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org. We're speaking with Desiree about her participation in the recent Cleveland Republican National Convention protests. We talk about how it was to be there and what kinds of things this event could say about anarchist organizing in the United States. The first question that I have is, would you feel okay introducing yourself and talking a little bit about what you do?
Yeah, for sure. So my name's Desiree. I'm from the Southeast. I'm an EMT, work as a nurse aide. I'm really involved in things centered around radical horizontal mutual aid, solidarity work, food not bombs. I work within a newly formed collective, a decentralized mutual aid disaster relief organization. And I do a lot of work within refugee and resettled communities here. And I do international human rights monitoring, in Palestine and in the occupied West Bank.
Could you talk a little bit more about the center that you mentioned, or the refugee resettlement stuff?
Yeah, for sure. So we started this back in December. We were totally a response to governors in the United States saying that Syrian refugees wouldn't be allowed in their states, which absolutely cannot be enforced. It was just rhetoric and propaganda to increase anti-immigrant sentiment. So us forming this collective was a total knee-jerk response saying, no, people are totally welcome here. We didn't know what it would turn into, what it would look like, but it ended up in being some really close personal friendships with families here. The government actually, in my community, resettled folks and families 9 and 10 to a 1 or 2 bedroom small tiny apartment in a community that has high drug rates, is really impoverished, and gives them very little assistance. A lot of them have trouble with, transitioning in the culture, transitioning with a language barrier, and they need these things to be able to acclimate, to be able to find work. So that's where we come in. We have a collective of over 700 people nationwide who offer English courses if that's what folks would like. We offer transportation. We've been able to have really, really free markets every single month where we've given hundreds of pounds of food away, books, clothing, and try to pull resources. So there's a backup fund if anybody needs legal aid or medical support. So it's really kind of ramshackle, and we just were basically here and we listen, and we provide assistance to, you know, anyone needing support.
It's incredible that it's 700 people. Like you said, that's totally cool. With such a huge group of people, it must have taken a lot of outreach and a lot of organization to get people on board. Is that true?
Actually, surprisingly, it was the opposite. I think what happened was, I mean, we were even surprised. We didn't know if anybody would want to be involved in it. But it turns out that, you know, people like Chris Christie, a detestable human being, saying things like, you know, even a five-year-old Syrian orphan, I would say, is not allowed here. And people will listen to that. And people that are still, you know, attached to their humanity were like, you know, hell no. And when we created, you know, not that we're the only pathway, but when we created this path for people to show solidarity with resettled folks, with folks like, you know, escaping the violence of a civil war that we had a hand in, violence of economic injustice and war, things that all those things that this country had a huge part in, you know, people wanted to help. And when we started, like, it spread so quickly, and it was just a really beautiful thing, like organic thing to see happen. You know, we're not doing big, amazing things, but we're showing tons of acts of love and welcoming to folks. And that's really meaningful. It's been really, really incredible.
Definitely. And in a world that, you know, tells people in no uncertain terms that they are not welcome or they are not valued or they are not worth anything, I think that even in your words, like a ramshackle group of people showing basic acts of humanity, which is, you know, it's sad under late capitalism that, like, that's a thing. But, like, I think it's incredible that you're doing this, and it takes a lot of energy to maintain that. So total kudos to y'all for doing that. I had no idea about any of that. That's so cool.
Thank you.
How can people support y'all if they're not connected with the network?
So a friend of mine named the group Love Has No Borders. I think there's a couple other groups by that name, but we're on Facebook, Love Has No Borders group community page on Facebook. And we have an event actually Sunday in Tampa, which is where I live. And we have a food delivery program where we're going to be delivering goods by a Muslim organization. And we deliver it to families, and we have small candy bags for children for Eid celebrations. So yeah, if they want to get in touch with us, unfortunately, all we have is Facebook right now to connect with that collective, and, you know, it's welcomed.
Well, thank you so much for talking about all of that. Again, I had no idea that that was going on in Tampa. So what I did reach out to talk to you about was the RNC that happened recently.
Right.
Will you talk about, and I understand that you were there hanging out, will you talk a bit about protesting at the RNC in Cleveland, right?
Yeah, Cleveland.
Cool. About how many people were there, and what was the organizing generally like?
You know, I thought a lot about how to convey that. I know folks on the ground had to endure, like, you know, pretty textbook preemptive police and state intimidation tactics. Like, folks got home visits, questioned, people were followed on Facebook and basically stalked on social media by police and FBI in advance of it. So things felt very loose. We didn't find and couldn't find or determine, like, a calendar of events. So people were just kind of trying to follow Twitter and find out where gatherings were happening at any given time and, like, trying to get to them. And there were some big events that were already organized and had group pages or event pages for. But there was, you know, my expectation was that the streets would be teeming with anarchists and folks that were, at the very least, against Trump's, like, fascist, misogynist, racist, xenophobic platforms. But honestly, it was a low turnout. There was probably maybe 1,000 protesters and probably around 50 to 70 anarchist folks and Antifa there. I can go through, like, the days, if you like, of the events that happened. Or
that would be awesome, just to give listeners who weren't there a chance to visualize it for themselves.
Yeah, for sure. So, like, when we got there on Sunday night, driving through the city it was a little surreal. It was National Guard, state cops from all over the country. There was SWAT, there was helicopters, there was miles and miles of metal barricades everywhere. Like, metal barricade corridors set up and, like, almost cages set up. all around the city. On Monday, when we got out in the streets, there ended up being a march, like an end poverty march. The march was, it was really disillusioning for me. It was really frustrating. The cops were incredibly aggressive, and my comrades and I were walking, and cops were antagonizing us and like jamming their bike handles into our sides, and made my friend almost fall by like hitting him in the leg with a bike tire and hitting me in the ankle. And when we were confronting them about it, liberals were rushing through to quiet us and tell us that's not what we're there for, and then making a huge show out of thanking police, which is something that kind of went on the whole, you know, through the whole time I was there, where people, you know, on the same streets where cops gunned down Tamir Rice, people were profusely thanking them for their, quote, service. So that's how the first part of the day ended. I know that Antifa and medics ended up following. There was like Soldiers of Odin people there. Yeah. For people that don't know, they're like anti-immigrant, like street patrol or something. And they were spotted. Some of them, I believe, were boasting about having knives and flashing like large knives that they had and stuff. So they were like contained and followed by Antifa folks and medics. And, you know, that went on for like an hour. Now, I know that other people had confrontations with fascists or white nationalists that were there. I don't exactly know their numbers, but the next day is when, like day two, is when things kind of got really intense. Kind of started off with a few folks had climbed, like they scaled a 600-foot flagpole. It was like two flagpoles, and they hung a banner that said, "Don't Trump our communities." On the byline was like a statement on the intersectionality of immigrant justice and climate justice, and those three folks were arrested. And then we had gotten word that there was going to be a fascist gathering happening, and around 40 of us gathered and were walking down there. We were going down there to where the gathering was, and the fascists weren't there. There was nobody there, so we ended up turning around and walking back to this area called Public Square. And this area was like kind of like, I don't know, like ground zero for the RNC, at least for the like street presence. There was, you know, Westboro Baptist Church, Bikers for Trump. There was like heavily armed white racist border vigilante people there. There was, you know, Alex Jones was there. It was just this ridiculous grouping of people. And we marched up there just to see what was going on. And immediately upon like spotting us, the cops dove in front of us and created this barrier of bicycles that we couldn't cross. And it was really ridiculous because there was no protest. There was no, we weren't doing anything. We were walking up to the square to see what was going on. And the cops, turns out, thought that they were valiantly defending Westboro Baptist Church. What ended up being a spoof, Eastboro Baptist Church, holding signs mocking, you know, Westboro Baptist Church. And so we, yeah, it was really hilarious. And we were trying to point out to them, like, you're defending a spoof right now, just so you know, like, turn around and look at the joke. And it devolved into like such ridiculousness that we had decided to just walk away. Like, you know, let's move out of this space. This is really silly. And even the live streamers were like questioning the cops on their political policing, you know, because anarchists are walking through a public space. They just literally like blocked us off and like continued surrounding us. And this happened a lot throughout the RNC. But as we were walking away, I was talking to a friend of mine about what just happened. And I turned around and the entire square was following us. It was like 200 people. There was media. There was tons of cops, tons of Trump supporters following closely behind us and like trying to surround us. And I was like completely confused because they were like, it was no march. There was no signs. There was no banner at that time. There was no nothing. It was just a crowd of people walking. So that went into literally like an hour and a half of cops kettling us, chasing us through the streets, chasing us through parking garages and through alleyways. And at one point, at one intersection, they completely went on the attack and started, cops did, and started like throwing, like violently throwing their bicycles into our crowd of folks that was standing there, knocking people down on the ground. A friend of mine, his shorts like completely tore and his leg was bleeding. And
it was completely senseless. It was just police attacking a group of folks that they were corralling in and kettling for all this time. So when that eventually started dying down, because folks were breaking off into small groups, we broke off and walked a few blocks and went into a cafe and bought a drink. And immediately this giant security guard came up to us and stood there and wouldn't leave us and was asking us why we were there, even though we had drinks in our hands that we'd just paid for. And eventually we were told to leave, that the Secret Service was there. So for absolutely no reason, we were thrown out. So that was day two. And on day three, that was the day I left that evening. There was supposed to be an FTP, anti-police, like radical roving dance party at some point midday. And we showed up for it in the same area, the public square area. And there was about five of us that showed up at first. And within maybe 4 minutes, we were surrounded by 20, 30 cops on all sides. And they started surrounding us so much that we decided to quietly just break off into groups and circulate around. And a group of cops followed each small group of us. And we were just literally walking cops back and forth across the street. They were just like, wouldn't leave us. They were just following us everywhere until the action was eventually called off. And when we attempted to walk away, me and two of my comrades, six cops followed us. And they continued following us for blocks and blocks until we ducked down an alleyway and started kind of running through people, and cops were like chasing us from behind, kicked my friend in the back of the leg. It was pretty intense and pretty ridiculous because, again, we'd done absolutely nothing. Yeah, and then at that point, we literally kind of ran headlong into the RevCom folks that were burning a flag during a demonstration, and that ended up in 17, I believe, of them being arrested. And we saw the arrestees, like, they were being, like violently arrested and taken into custody. So it was really intense and pretty frustrating, not really what I had expected. And in the case of these RevCom folks, the cops had circulated that the people setting the flag on fire had set themselves on fire, so they had to move in. And there's absolutely no video evidence of that. There's no physical evidence of that. It was just a reason, a narrative, so that they could go in and arrest folks. And this is how the entire RNC was. It was so intense that somebody initiated like police state bingo, and there's like bingo cards were going around.
God. Oh God.
Yeah.
And the RevCom, that's the Revolutionary Communist Party. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this sounds like quite an unusually high and unusually heavy policing of anarchist and Antifa people, and not even like anarchist and Antifa, since Revolutionary Communist Party was hit pretty hard by the flag burning thing, by police repression. I myself have never been to a national convention, but I was at the Pittsburgh G20, and I don't remember a long time ago. So I don't remember anything like that. Do you have any thoughts on why the police and National Guard and SWAT and helicopters and all of that, why that initial response was so high and people seemed to be on such high alert from the 100 anarchists who were there?
Elevated their offensive based on what our response, I feel iffy saying this, but what our response should have been. You know, I don't want to blame or shame anyone who couldn't get there. I understand people have, you know, circumstances holding them back, but we had a strong opportunity. And I think what they expected was our presence in mass and us taking this opportunity to transform this fascist empowered space and confront it. And they calibrated their response to that. And we didn't give them much reason to advance like they did, but I mean, that didn't stop them. They exercised every bit, I believe, militancy that they would have if there was 10,000 of us, you know, instead of just, you know, 50 or 70 of us. So, you know, I think it was somewhat of a missed opportunity, something that slipped through our fingers. I don't think it's detrimental, but I think that it could have set a tone for what they would have been waiting for if Trump's elected frighteningly into the White House.
What, in your opinion, what was the low turnout due to? Like, do you have any opinions on why there was such a low, like, anarchist and Antifa turnout to this convention?
You know, I can't say for sure. I can say that I heard that the Traditionalist Workers Party that had attacked Antifa Sacramento folks, that they were boasting about making the RNC like a bloodbath. And there was other groups and other neo-Nazi people that were claiming that they were going to come and, you know, spreading this information. So I'm not sure if folks expected like a violent confrontation. That might be it. It might also be that people are like struggling to get by day to day. And a lot of our folks are like spread really thin, organizing on numerous different fronts and fighting so many struggles and really overwhelmed. So, I mean, that could also have been it. I think that people could have anticipated that there was going to be this kind of police response. It was like a military occupation of Cleveland, and they could have sensed that there would be not much room to breathe. It could have been any number of things. You know, I've gone to every Trump appearance in my community, and I knew I had to be at the RNC because he's rising up just like other fascists in history have risen up. So I feel like we have to come strong and come early. And it's getting late in the race now, but I'd really had expectations of what this could have been. And I was, you know, somewhat just disappointed, I guess, by the showing.
Definitely. What were your expectations? Were you expecting more of an Antifa presence?
I was. And also I was expecting, and I told a friend of mine that I was driving up there with, like, I'll actually be kind of surprised if we get out of this without arrests or injuries. You know, we were both kind of conferring over, like, what to expect, what was happening, you know, what would happen, you know, but it ended up being really different. And, you know, it's okay. There'll be more opportunities in the future for us to organize like this. But, I mean, I think this was the space for that. So, I mean, what I expected was to walk into streets where I, you know, have to, it would be, you know, elbow to elbow. And it just wasn't that.
Gotcha. So you've spoken a bunch about the fascist presence there and all of the, like, alternative news sources that I have been reading since the convention, like It's Going Down and Unicorn Riot, really talked up the fascist presence there, and it seems to have been like somewhat unprecedented, like an unprecedentedly huge fascist presence. Could you talk a little bit about your impression of how their organizing was like and why you think there was so many, apart from them being emboldened by Trump's like pretty overt fascism?
You know, I think it was possibly just the same clumsy neo-Nazi fascist. Like, they showed up, they flashed some weapons, and they basically like patrolled around the city. I didn't see a lot of it. I know that there were some, I guess prominent figures in their circles that had showed up, like Matthew Heimbeck, I believe is his name, from the TWP. So, I mean, there were folks that were preying on activists filming. I saw footage of one of them getting like walked out, like contained and walked out of the area until he yelled to cops for help. You know, I think my upset, a lot of it came from, it was not just established, outed fascists and neo-Nazis. It was a lot of everyday, a lot of bro culture folks that were feeling super legitimized and running on lightly verbally attacking people that were holding like thoughtful political critique demonstrations and, you know, getting shouted down by folks. The police were so tightly circling and supporting and protecting KKK or Westboro Baptist Church, white supremacist folks and Islamophobic, xenophobic, anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant folks that were there, that there was no way to get even near them. It was totally the sectioned off scene where, I mean, I didn't see a lot of like the fascist organizing. They had said that they were going to be out there defending Trump supporters. You know, I didn't see a lot of this. I didn't see a lot of confrontation or careful organizing or anything going on in that community.
Do you think that the low anti-authoritarian, anarchist, anti-fascist turnout says something about how we in the United States, like where our bent is going, and like, is our bent changing? Were we just really, really spooked, or were we just apathetic? I'm curious about your impressions about what that says about where we are right now, so that we can take lessons from it or think about maybe other opportunities for anti-fascist organizing moving from this point onward, or what are your thoughts on that?
For sure. I mean, it may be wishful thinking, but I definitely don't feel like it's apathy that's what's happening, because if you look at places where Trump rallies are, there at times have been huge presences of people, you know, trying to transform the space, attacking the message, and folks that support it. I don't know what to make of it, except that the one thing I know that I feel is that I know a lot of folks are fighting. I mean, we are not just dealing with a situation with Trump right now. We're dealing with the mass murder of a person from the Black and Brown community, one every 28 hours. There's people rising up, dealing with that situation, fighting for police abolition, and supporting movements that are fighting under that message. So the only thing I can think is we have so many battles happening that folks are fighting where they stand, they're fighting in their communities. And, you know, I mean, it was difficult for me to afford the trip. I don't know why the low numbers. I don't know why folks would not seize the opportunity to confront this head on. But I can only hope that, you know, people within their communities are just organizing, and we can take lesson from this, not let it, you know, affect us moving forward. Just take the lesson that, you know, we weren't there. We let an opportunity slip through our fingers and just let it, you know, kind of be wind at our movement's back to move forward, you know, and figure out how we can correct things like that and make sure that maybe we can support folks who want to be there financially or helping them with transportation or something. You know, it's really hard to say why people weren't there. Like, I feel they should have been.
Well, I think you touched on a really important point with there being so many battles right now that people are actively engaged in their communities, but also bringing the point that there, you know, this is a really unprecedented time, perhaps like in our lifetimes, fascism and white supremacy and like entrenched racism is very much like on some sort of upswing. And I think that we as anarchists, as anti-authoritarians, like need to address that and need to like respond with as much force as the force which is coming at us for, you know, the white supremacist force. We need to do that, I think. So you spoke a little bit about people in Cleveland having like home visits from FBI and police, preemptive visits. I spoke to another person who was just like, a lot of people in Cleveland just kind of skipped town, and they weren't being judgmental in that. They were being like, they were just so heavily intimidated by the law that they just felt totally freaked out. Can you speak a little bit more about this? And did you speak to anybody from Cleveland who was there, and like, how was their experiences? If you can talk about that at all.
Yeah, I mean, I don't obviously want to name anybody. I talked to someone in preparation for going out there that I was going to be helping out with food and getting food to folks and stuff at different hours and stuff. And the statement was like, people were all, you know, nervous or feeling uncomfortable. That community had been targeted by cops and folks had been arrested, you know, in the recent history. And so the one thing that evidenced this, and I, you know, I, I can totally understand. You know, I wasn't the one on the ground trying to organize in advance of this like mass convergence, having a deal with police stalking me and visiting my house. So absolutely no judgments. But at the table where we were at, we were asked to not have our black and red flag out because, quote, they promised police they weren't going to be protesting. So that to me really says something. Like the fact that even to exist in that space to share food, totally nonviolent, they had to engage in some kind of like verbal like promise or affirmation with cops that they wouldn't be engaged in any like civil disobedience or protest in any kind. So, I mean, it's the same thing. The RNC was in the community where I now live. I didn't live here at the time, but friends of mine have said the same exact thing. The cops and FBI showed up at their house, questioning them, showing up at their family's houses, questioning them. And, you know, people are literally being stalked on social media, targeted by cops, you know, and I'm sure in the aftermath, cops are going to be poring over footage that's come out. You know, I mean, I found the snitch Brandon Darby in the streets filming and preying on people.
Brandon Darby was there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I had an altercation with him, actually. Yeah, I found him in Public Square. He had been boasting on Twitter, to be clear, that he was going to be showing up there and basically kind of coyly, like, threatening folks that he was going to be there without a mask on and filming people. And we were in Public Square, and I spotted him with this, like, fancy camera and this, like, microphone with this fuzzy thing over it, and he was filming folks that I was standing near. And, you know, I confronted him and a few other people confronted him, and he's published that video. And Cassandra Fairbanks, I guess an associate or friend of his or something, was stalking around in the crowd too. So, you know, with that presence there, along with police intimidation and stuff, I mean, I can only imagine what, you know, the folks organizing on the ground had to deal with on top of trying to provide the elements like medical, legal, and food for folks that were coming in from out of town.
What f***ing nerve on his part. And just for some context, Brandon Darby, for listeners who aren't aware, was an informant for the FBI, I believe, in a previous RNC when the RNC happened in Minneapolis. Do you remember what year that was?
2008.
And he sent a number of people to prison based on the
entrapment.
Yeah, that's the word I was looking for. So for him to be at this RNC is pretty nervy and pretty disgusting. And wow. Yeah, I had no idea.
Yeah, on top of his walking activists and influencing activists into a plot that ended up getting them imprisoned, he also, through his snitching and informing and completely fabricating things, was, in my opinion, the cause of a Palestinian man's suicide, which I confronted him about there as well and asked him if he thought about the fact that this man killed himself because of him. And his response was, because of him, Israeli babies are alive today. So he lives in a complete fantasy world. And, you know, he's actively and openly working to entrap folks, to film them, to, get them jailed. And then he makes comments and jokes on his Twitter about, don't we have friends in jail to write the ones that he sent there? So he's pretty nervy. And it was a frustrating situation to see him there, you know, doing exactly what he said he was going to do, filming and trying to, you know, identify and, catch folks doing whatever.
Yeah, definitely. How are you doing right now? Like, how are you feeling about all of this, apart from, like, political analyses?
I mean, it's like coming back from Palestine, like, being somewhere where it feels like there's a military occupation and, you know, intense situations. It was just to me, it was a mixture of somewhat disappointment, but also, you know, I was really stoked about the folks that were there and everybody that worked really hard. The people that were there that showed up were out in the streets every single day, dealing with cops, following them, dealing with cops from the minute they like pulled up in their car on any given day, like cops following them and showing up and surrounding us. So, and I felt great about the people that were there, a little bit disappointed for some missed opportunities, but just, you know, moving on, moving forward with stuff happening in my community. And, you know, Trump was here a couple days ago, back in my hometown, or back in, you know, the community I live in. So it's just, you know, things never stop.
No, they never do. But I think we need to hold each other through it and make sure that we have energy to go on and to keep alive in so many ways.
Yeah, for sure.
But you mentioned before that you've been to a bunch of occasions where Trump has visited, like where you're at. I was wondering if you've been to any other similar mobilizations, like the national conventions or the G conventions. And if so, can you compare and contrast, like, how it felt to be there versus how it felt to be at the RNC in Cleveland?
The only other, like, similar experience here, well, somewhat similar, was biotech in Philadelphia. There was a biotech conference, I believe it would have been 2007 or 8, somewhere around there. And I was there protesting pharmaceutical companies with in the animal liberation movement, just animal rights folks. And it was, you know, we actually ended up getting confronted by a woman who showed up in the middle of biotech and kind of clung to us, and ended up finding out 7 months later that she was a snitch or a detective. It was pretty intense. Biotech is what I hoped that this RNC would be. I don't really have a lot of giant mobilizations in the U.S. to compare it to, but it did make me think about, you know, military occupation and other lands where cops are politically policing and attacking folks and being completely aggressive with no provocation. If that gives you any context of you know, what the feeling was like being there.
Certainly. Those are all of the questions that I have. Is there anything that else that you wanted to add?
I just keep organizing, keep fighting, and, you know, we have to, you know, there was something written in a fascism zine that says, you know, we have to beat fascists every time. They only have to beat us once. So we really have to, like, continue struggling. And, like, my heart is, like, lifted and strengthened by people, like, in movements everywhere, you know, that are fighting this. So for my part, I'll keep fighting here for my community. And, yeah, that's all.
Desiree, thank you so much for coming on to The Final Straw and talking about your experiences at the RNC. It's been super helpful for me to talk to you. Hopefully it's been really helpful for people to listen, and much, much appreciated.
Oh, thank you, Adrian. I appreciate it.
And we just spoke with Desiree about the RNC. If you would like to see more accounts from anarchist perspectives on this event, you can visit the website itsgoingdown.org and follow the links to the RNC. If you would like to support the arrestees at this event, you can visit the Ohio National Lawyers Guild page at ohionlg.com.
We're listening to White Nightmare by Interterrestrials off of their self-titled album.
Story about the shit. Patriotism like faith in the state. Relators, xenophobia and race hate. The innocents died when the war flags flew. A scared human being's no different from you. In a God of mercy's name, they are to be cleansed. The commies, the subverts, the gypsies and you.
This is At the Foot of Mount Driscoll by Thou off of their album Heathen.
We are
You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard in KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWA LP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS LP in Columbus, Ohio. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. Also, if you're interested in rebroadcasting any episode or segment, you're free to do so. Just send us an email so we know that you're out there. If you care to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806. The show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee, located at 610 Haywood Road. Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville, specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. You can find a sample of Firestorm's catalog of books and zines, plus a full calendar of events at their website, firestorm.coop.